afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, newly appointed Minister of State Pascal Donoghue on the tumultuous week that was and the challenges that lie ahead. The Troika spends the weekend studying the books as the government battles to ease up on austerity in the October budget, and a newly released section of the Murphy Report harshly criticises the Gardaí and successive archbishops for allowing Father Patrick McCabe to continue abusing children for years. But first, the news with Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon. Northern Ireland's Chief Constable has condemned rioting by loyalist protesters in Belfast last night, in which at least 32 police officers were injured. The most serious incidents occurred after an Orange Order parade was prevented from returning through Ardoyne in North Belfast by police who were implementing a ruling of the Parades Commission. The DUP MP Nigel Dodds was also injured after being struck by a missile, but he was discharged from hospital after treatment. At a news conference today, Matt Baggett accused some within the Orange Order leadership of being reckless. The Orange Order has suspended its demonstration in the area, but Northern Ireland's Secretary of State Theresa Villiers says it should be called off.
I welcome the fact that they did call for a suspension of their protest, but for the moment it is only a suspension. I think they need to call it off indefinitely because this continues to be a tense situation. And actually I think the way forward is a resumption of the kind of local dialogue that had started before the determination was made by the Parades Commission.
Gardaí and County Kerry say they're concerned for the welfare of a man in his 50s who remains unaccounted for following an explosion at a laundrette in Killarney this morning. It may take several hours before they gain access to the building on Brewery Lane in the centre of the town, where the explosion occurred shortly before 6:30. The area has been cordoned off. A hotel which backs onto the premises is among a number of buildings which had to be evacuated. Several people received minor injuries, and more than a dozen other business premises were damaged. The French rail company SNCF has announced that a technical fault on the track caused the crash of an intercity train which derailed at a station south of Paris yesterday. At least six people died in the incident, and emergency crews are still searching the wreckage. The focus of the inquiry is to work out how a metal bar holding together two sections of track near switching points became loose, causing the train to derail. The French Transport Minister said the accident could have been much worse had it not been for the driver alerting oncoming trains. Investigators have started work to establish the cause of a fire on a Boeing 787 Dreamliner at London's Heathrow Airport yesterday. The fire broke out on the plane, operated by Ethiopian Airlines, when it was parked at a remote stand with no passengers on board. The outbreak is seen as a new setback for the 787 after it was grounded at the start of the year over battery problems. There has been no official indication as to what could have caused the latest fire. In Spain, at least 20 people have been injured at the annual Running of the Bulls festival in Pamplona. An Irishman is said to be among those injured in a pile-up of runners and bulls at the entrance to the bull ring where the run ends. Several of the injured were treated in the stadium. The weather forecast. Hot and mostly sunny over Munster and Leinster again this afternoon and evening. Cloudier over Connacht and Ulster and a bit less warm. Later in the day there is a risk of isolated heavy showers in the south. Highest temperatures ranging 18 to 24 degrees over the north and the west and 24 to 29 degrees across the south and the east. That's the news for the moment. Back now to Clare.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. We welcome your views on any of the topics on the programme today. Our text number is 51551. Saturday at rte.ie is the email, and the Twitter address is at Saturday RTE. Joining us, we have Minister of State for European Affairs, Pascal Donoghue, Lisa Hand, political writer with the Irish Independent, and Eamon Ryan, leader of the Green Party and former minister. You're all very welcome. Thanks for being with us. We'll have more joining us a little bit later on. But first of all, congratulations, Pascal.
Thank you very much, Clare.
Delighted, I'm sure.
I'm over the moon. It's funny, when you used the word minister there, I was half expecting somebody else to come in. So it's all it's still coming as a huge surprise to me, but I'm getting to grips with what I need to do.
Are you actually working on the brief now? I mean, I know you haven't had much time since it all happened so quickly, but have you been in the office, in the department?
Absolutely. Yesterday morning, I met the three different secretary generals that I will be working with. I heard what all of them had to say about what the role involves, because I've been a member of the EU Affairs Committee now for nearly 8 years. I already have some very clear ideas regarding the areas that I want to work on. And then yesterday afternoon, I requested to go and meet the different departments that are involved in that work. So in between talking to a number of people yesterday, I made sure I met many of the key people that I'll be working with and talked about the kind of things I already believe are important in the role.
And you'll be based, will you, in the Department of the Taoiseach, as Lucinda Creighton was?
I will indeed, though obviously my role will involve an awful lot of time on the road in different countries and meeting people and representing our country. But I'll be primarily based out of the Department of the Taoiseach. When I was talking to Eamon about this earlier on, I mean, when I got the call to go in early on Friday morning, it was actually only the second time I'd ever been in government buildings. And the first time was for a cup of tea. So when I went in there on Friday morning to have a meeting with the Taoiseach and then be appointed, it was an extraordinary experience. But I suppose I'm a bit beyond that now and focusing in on what I want to do and how I'm going to organise the coming weeks and months.
Lucinda was telling Marion that she was clearing out the office yesterday. You didn't have any awkward moments or...
No, not at all. Lucinda is was and is a very good friend of mine. I met her first in 2003. I served on the City Council with her. Mm-hmm. I've obviously then served in the Oireachtas with her over the last number of years. I met her last Wednesday night for a long chat about things. Though never in my dreams when I was sitting down talking to her did I believe I was going to end up in her role the following week.
But we all had heard that your name was in the frame. I mean, you must have heard it yourself.
I did. But look, I mean, you can get driven wild by this kind of speculation. I mean, the essence of political life is that people are always focusing on, you know, the factual and the counterfactual. I mean, what's happening and what could be happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, my name has been associated enough times that when things kind of go wrong, and then when I heard this kind of speculation beginning to believe, I mean, my attitude was, well, we have a job, somebody in the job. It's Lucinda. She's doing a very good job there. She's going to make her mind up what she wants to do. Whenever any thoughts came into my mind on the basis of what some people might have been writing or saying, I slapped them quickly down.
And then you missed the calls when they came.
I missed three phone calls from the Department of the Taoiseach. And if I'd missed the fourth one, God knows what might have happened.
I wonder who was next on the list.
I'm talking about the counterfactual. I mightn't be here. I was on Gardiner Street. Regina Doherty, my friend, she's a TD from Meath, was giving me a lift home after the Dáil sitting. And I mean, the last thing I was thinking of was looking at my phone. All I was thinking about, to be honest, was going to bed because it's been such a long week. And by chance, you know, I don't often check my phone at nearly 1 o'clock in the morning. I noticed it was three phone calls that I'd missed and then a very focused text message asking me to return quickly. Regina was good enough to swiftly execute that that direction. We sped back up into government buildings and there was a guard waiting for me, a member of staff there to bring me up.
And you spoke about probably needing to travel quite a bit now. I mean, how will that impact you personally? Because I know you've got young family and so on. I mean,
sure.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. I mean, the most most important thing in my life is my family and looking after them. I'll just have to sit down and come with a plan about how I make it all work. Mm-hmm. I'm so humbled to be in this role, and I know I understand how deeply cynical people have become about political life, and correctly so, given the terrible difficulty that everybody's now managing. But, you know, I gave up my job to stand in a general election there in 2006. I resigned from a job. I didn't get elected then in that election. Luckily I got elected to the Senate. And, you know, I'm really motivated by the idea of public service and doing your best. And I'm going to do that for representing my country in every way I can. Mm-hmm. And I will find a way of managing that then with family life. And then obviously my constituents in Dublin Central are gigantically important. I'm going to be standing in a far smaller constituency in the next general election. Want to do all I can to get re-elected. So I have to manage that as well. But I'm going to work as hard as I can. And I mean, if I've learned anything from the last few weeks, it's the idea that you truly never know what's around the corner.
And
you have to focus in on the here and now and do the best with what's there. That's what I'm going to do now.
Okay. I want to have a look back now at what happened over the last week. And I know that everybody's probably exhausted with the substantive argument. But when it comes to how it was handled, Lise, maybe if we come to you, the whip system, the late hour, the carry on, the bar being open late and all of that. Look back on the week for me and tell me what you thought.
Well, I think if this week did show something is that there is quite a long way to go on the issue of reforming the way that the Oireachtas does its business. You know, there is a certain sense of head scratching about, you know, you wait 30 years, you know, for this legislation, or 21, depending on, you know, between the X case and the original referendum, for this piece of legislation to be enacted. And then there was a need for an emergency late night sitting until 5 a.m. to push this through. You know, this wasn't emergency legislation. This wasn't like the night of the bank guarantee. This wasn't like the night that of the liquidation of Anglo, where time was of the essence. This was something that was 3 decades, you know, knocking about, waiting for someone to deal with it. And it really was quite shambolic. There was no reason why.
I was just going to ask you that, because that was a Fianna Fáil's argument. So why are we here until 5 o'clock in the morning? Did you get an explanation? Did you feel?
No, I mean, I think you see, it goes back to the way that they actually do business, because there was a feeling on paper that this particular stage of proceedings should have gone much faster, that every deputy wouldn't stand up and essentially make long speeches, which really reiterating arguments that have been made at very varying earlier stages of the passage of this bill to the Oireachtas. A lot of the same arguments we heard when the bill was in committee stage were rehashed, reheated, people going back over the same points of view, been giving far too much time. So therefore, what should have been a reasonably brisk stage just became longer and longer and longer. Originally, the Dáil was supposed to adjourn at 10 p.m, which is reasonable. Sometimes, you know, when there's a large piece of legislation going through, they will sit until that hour. Then it went out to midnight. Then we heard it was going to be at least 2 a.m. And then it went out to 5. Now, there was no reason. There was absolutely no reason for this.
Telling me, though, Lise, earlier in the day, Enda Kenny had said, I want to get rid of this tonight.
That's right. But, you know, really, there was no question at that stage of getting rid of it, so to speak. You know, it was an unfortunate term, a phrase for something that has taken so long, you know, to use this sort of just sort of get it over and done with. There was absolutely no reason for it. The government obviously were very reluctant to impose a guillotine on this bill in any shape or form, because then this could have been used as a counter argument if any challenges were taken in the courts about this, that it was rushed through. So I think their attitude was, let everybody talk down the clock and have everybody have their say. But it could have been done in such a structured way. There was no reason that the debate couldn't have been rescheduled or rearranged to continue the next day or into Friday, perhaps even with sitting into next week. The Dáil is supposed to rise for the summer next Thursday. But again, there was no reason why it couldn't sit for an extra few days. It was just badly managed and badly handled. And it shows really that, you know, and then, of course, the whole point about the bar remaining open, of course. And once again, the Dáil bar became the focus of attention. Now, my point of view is responsible adults. They're not exactly dragged in and drinkers and forced down their neck. But there's no reason why that bar, like the public part of the bar in Leinster House, doesn't close at normal times. And if people, you know, can sit there and have teas and coffees and so on. I mean, you don't get into a car, you know, with a whole pile of drink and drive home. So, I mean, you don't press a button on an extremely important piece of legislation.
I was reading a piece today on thejournal.ie and the reporter there spoke to a number of TDs who were willing to admit, look, I had one or two pints and that's not unusual and it's grand and all the rest. It's not really, though, is it, when you think about it? I mean, who of us goes to work and has a couple of pints and then is expected to do or expects themselves to do a decent job?
Well, this is it. And then you see, of course, also that, you know, it becomes this myth is created that everybody, the TDs and the ministers, are roaming the corridors completely and utterly hammered. And
that's not the case
either,
to be fair.
Which is not the case, no. But this is what I think, the myth arises when really you know, the majority of them were in there, maybe had one or two. But again, I don't drink in work. I certainly didn't drink that night because I was glued to the gallery, sitting in the gallery watching the entire proceedings. So, you know, and I didn't see any overt signs of anyone staggering around the chamber either. But it's unprofessional. It's a bad, it creates a bad image. You know, God knows politics, the image of politics is taken a battering over countless years. And really this image that the bar is open and they're in and out and they can have throw a few pints into them and then go into the chamber and press a button. You know, and then you could argue that then when you have shambolic scenes do develop, a la the so-called Lapgate involving Tom Barry and Anya Collins, or Labour TD Michael McNamara getting into a complete muddle about which button to press, then everybody goes, well, if the dog bar wasn't open, that may not have happened, or whatever, even though drink may not have been involved. It creates the impression of chaos and people not doing their job correctly, everybody's mind not being on the work, and it doesn't create the atmosphere of a business like professional workplace.
Would there be uproar, Pascal, if you tried to close the dog bar?
No, not at all. I mean, I take Lisa's point. I mean, the bit I'm struck by, I mean, I've only been involved in one other late night sitting, which is the night of the elimination of the promissory note. And I'm happy to be corrected by Lisa here on this point, but my recollection is that the Dáil Bar shut down at a point in at the normal point in time, because I have a strong recollection of many of us being in the canteen at 2 or 3 in the morning drinking tea. Or being in the Dáil Chamber. I don't believe that it would be. Normally it shuts, you know, kind of, you know, at the end of the night, in line with other premises. In relation to it, should it have been open in, you know, at that point? I mean, I was in the Dáil Bar myself for some of that night, drinking a copious cups of tea, as lots of my other colleagues were.
But there were others drinking.
I don't believe it should be open, full stop. I don't believe it should be open. You know, I think the Dáil Bar has unfortunately become some kind of a mythic place of in the eyes of some people, kind of huge inappropriate behaviour. In my own experience, it's where most people go to have a quick bite of lunch, a cup of tea. And in the evenings now at the moment, it's actually been very few people in it whenever.
But if it's left open and it's serving alcohol until 5 a.m, that myth will flourish, whether it's true or not.
That's why I emphasise my point. I believe it should have been closed. I think the reason it stayed open is because what happened that night is the expectation is that that stage, that Wednesday night, the expectation was that it was actually going to finish quite quickly. Because while I accept the justifiable criticism regarding how it looked, the point is, this was the tail end of a process that's been going on most of the year. There was 2 different days of hearings in the health committee that went on, I think, for 6 or 7 days that everybody could participate. There was a second stage, and just to get away from the jargon, second stage is where TDs stand up and talk about the principles of the bill. The second stage of that bill went on for days. Tons of people spoke in it. Then there was a committee stage. And again, to get away from the jargon, there are committees where people go through the bill line by line. That went on for days.
Only the members of the committee, though.
Well, only members of the committee are entitled to change and vote on the bill. But any member of the Dáil or Shannon can go in and can contribute. And tons of people did. So the pity of all of this is, until we got to that point, the whole thing had gone on for months. It had gone through day by day, line by line. Tons of people had participated in it. And by the time we got to that point on Wednesday, I think the genuine expectation was that this was going to wrap up very quickly. And what happened during the day, and this was fifth stage, and again, what that means is people get the opportunity to speak again on parts of the bill and then conclude. But what happened, for reasons that are entirely understandable because of how important the issue is, most people who had participated in the bill got up and spoke again and spoke about the entire thing all over again.
And spoke on each amendment.
On each amendment. So what happened actually during the night is that it was due to finish at 10, wasn't it?
That's
then
right.
It was due to finish at 12. Then it was due to finish at 2. Then it was due to go up to 5. And while I accept the tenor of the discussion we're having here, the alternative was, and that people did not want to do this, was to look at a guillotine at any point. And again, what a guillotine means is the government decides to end the discussion.
But at that stage,
you
still had Thursday and Friday as options.
We did. And then we sat, if you look at the Wednesday, we actually started the discussion of the bill at 11:30 in the morning. It went through until the early afternoon. Then there was a separate bill. Mm-hmm. It started again at 5, went through to 5. And then we started on Thursday night again at 5 o'clock, and it sat through until around midnight. Now, I have to say, by the time we got to the second part of the day, people, for whatever reason, were a lot more brief and focused in the contributions they were making. Yeah. And perhaps, and then because of that, there didn't need to be a session on Friday. I actually taught myself at dinner time on Friday, when we're about to start all over again. I was convinced not only was I going to be in here on Friday, but I thought we'd be in on Saturday as well.
Right, and that didn't happen. Eamon, you're a veteran of all this stuff. Watching it from wherever you were during the week, what did you make of it? Lucinda has criticised the whip system today on Marion Finucane's programme, saying that, you know, when it comes to matters of conscience, that there should have been another way to do it, i.e. a free vote.
I think there's two things. Firstly, I think it's a terrible pity that mistake on the Wednesday, whatever you say, Pascal, about expecting it to finish at midnight, anyone could see, I think, experienced whip or the cabinet, when you have 160 amendments on such a contentious bill, that it wasn't, that it could have been given the space to run into the next day. And that should have been foreseen and should have been allowed for. And I think the fact that Taoiseach line, I want to get rid of this tonight, I think, I'm afraid, turned it into rather the Protection of Life Bill into the Protection of the Coalition Bill in some ways, in terms of it was about how he would manage his internal Fine Gael dissidents. And that was what drove the timing and the approach to it. And I think that's deeply unfortunate, because for all sides of this bill, and whatever your views on it, it would have been better to give it time to allow it conclude at 10 o'clock or even 8 o'clock on the Wednesday night and run into the Thursday and Friday. And I think that was a terrible mistake. And I think to a certain extent, that characteristic of kind of, I'm going to play power politics here, I'm going to be seen to be strong, you know, show strong leadership by really whipping my team in, by absolutely clamping down. If someone goes against it, they can't run again for Fine Gael and so on.
He's been lauded in many places
for that.
But
I'm not too sure if that's the type of power politics we need this day. I think there's a certain greater strength on some issues when you allow for different voices and allow different views to be heard. And I think this probably was one more than endless, particularly because Fine Gael themselves had set out a contrary position when they went before the people the last time. And I think he would have got the bill through. I think there would have been a majority. We've seen it. There was a relatively strong cross-party majority. I'm not so sure that power politics, that kind of strong man approach, is actually what we need in Irish politics at the moment.
Well, then on the other side of that, do you agree or not that Micheál Martin is weakened as a leader after what happened when he allowed a free vote? 14, wasn't it? 14 of his
yes.
TDs.
Five only voted.
Yeah, 14 of the 19 voted against how he was going to go.
I don't know. I think the fact that his own party set out that approach in their own convention maybe is the answer he would give. But listen, Fianna Fáil can answer for themselves. I know for the Green Party, historically, always in this issue, going right back, we've always said on certain matters.
I know, but if you're prepared
to
criticise Enda Kenny for playing power politics, what do you think of the result on the other side?
Fianna Fáil are the world's worst at playing the other game as well. I mean, God, they can play cute. And you see it in every council in this country where people vote strategically. The local Fianna Fáil councillor or a local Fine Gael councillor votes against something that's unpopular locally, and the rest of the councillors voted through. There's too much of that, I think, in Irish politics. And I think people would prefer, or people want, politics at this moment, which is slightly straighter, more honest, and where it isn't all just about following a party banner, you know, where you do allow room for distant voices. And I think it was a pity in a week, I think, for the general body politic, that a different voice is kind of seen, sorry, you're out. I think that is a pity. And I think, regardless of your views on the issue, and I would differ with Lucinda in terms of so many different things, but I think it is a pity for politics that was the message at the end of the week.
I think he was going to
sorry,
be...
Lise, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I think, you know, the Taoiseach would probably have shipped criticism no matter which way he went on this. If he'd allowed a free vote, he could very well have found himself in a position akin to that Micheál Martin is in now, as in he dithered, he didn't grasp the nettle when he should have, his authority has been weakened. And, you know, again, I think, you know, where Fianna Fáil are ironically trying to send, you know, build up a party that they're saying is new Fianna Fáil, a progressive party and so on. And yet you had the majority of the TDs voted against the bill. I think as well that Taoiseach is very wary about being seen, perceived in any way weak. I think he really wanted to, he was absolutely adamant from the start that the full whip would be applied. I mean, you had an instance where one senior minister was due to fly to Lithuania, Joan Burton, on the early hours of the morning of Thursday, and was told at the last minute, "You can't go. You need to be here. There's no exemptions unless for the Taoiseach and Tánaiste." And I think, you know, I think they probably did the numbers and realised if there was a free vote, there could have been a lot more people would have said voted against that. And that doesn't send out any kind of good message at all. Labour kept their discipline on this because obviously this was a massive part of their election manifesto that they wanted the X case to be legislated for. And I think that the Taoiseach was left in no choice. He absolutely had to come down the hard man on this. Otherwise, I think it would have massively undermined his authority in the party.
And he couldn't have told, say, if there were 30 TDs who had decided that they weren't going to vote. They couldn't have told them all that they weren't going to run for.
Absolutely. And he knows as well that everybody, you know, still watches the party for divisions and for so on. You know, the massive heave that, you know, predated his election as Taoiseach in summer 2010, you know, people watch for signs of dissidence within that party and for signs that people are unhappy with his authority and whatever. And I think this was just sending out a message, you know, it's my way or the highway.
I do think there's a bit of balance needed, though, when we're discussing this issue here. I mean, there is frequent and necessary calls for politicians to take leadership stances in relation to issues, not to try to be all things to all people. And then when somebody does take a leadership stance on the issue, not the kind of some of the accusations that are then made is of being authoritarian and trying to bully people. Now, in fairness, none of my colleagues here have done that. But this is an issue that for various reasons, nobody has wanted to fully deal with now for between 20 and 30 years. And the Taoiseach decided correctly that this needed to be dealt with and that he needed to ensure he led his party behind him in doing that. And while I really understand the sensitivity of many people in relation to this issue, once he laid out what he believed needs to be done in relation to us, he then made very clear that he wanted to lead his party and his government through us. And while I do understand all the focus and the criticism that's gone on in relation to the whip system, I think we should have a debate about this in the future. We should also bear in mind that, for example, in a jurisdiction like the United Kingdom, which has a very weak whip system, they actually have the kind of, an abortion regime that many people have said they don't want here in Ireland. If you look at, for example, their policy in relation to Europe and how that's changing, I'd struggle to see how a weak whip system in that jurisdiction has led to better policy making. I'd make the same point in relation to the American political system. Can anybody tell me that the absence of a weak whip system in America has led to better outcomes in their country in terms of issues like gun control, in terms of how they're managing their budgetary difficulties at the moment?
So moral issues aren't necessarily dealt with in a better way in those places.
But not just moral.
If I can just ask to bring it back to a very wider question of political reform at the moment. And the fear I have is that it's my way or the highway is not where we need to go in terms of political reform. What we need is a centralised executive to give power out to the other members in the parliament, to the opposition, yes, in kind of different ways, and to different voices within their own party.
Would you get anything done, though, if you did it that way?
I think one of the big lessons of this country in the last 20 years is we didn't listen to different voices. I think had we had a political system where you had dissonant voices allowed, had we had a Seanad, or if we could reform the Seanad where you allow all sorts of different voices in, I think in the long run you'd get better politics, you get better decision making. So it's my way or the highway is one way of the doll could go. And I fear that's where Enda Kenny has moved or has shown in the last 2 years. He's decided to, ever since he defeated Richard Bruton through that struggle, he said that's my trump card.
Well, my way in the highway isn't the sole prerogative of this particular Taoiseach. I think you could apply that to previous Taoiseach as well. You know, I think that on this issue, I genuinely think that he just made his decision. Now, also, I'd like to make the point that, of course, really this government were forced to make to put abortion legislation back on the agenda, really by the tragedy involving the death of Savita Halappanavar the end of last year. And I mean, the question arises, was that, you know, would this government really have kicked this back, you know, back onto the back burner where it's remained for the last three decades without that
public legislation that's to deal with that.
It's my way or highway is get rid of the Seanad. It's my way or highway is don't give power back to local government. It's my way or the highway means you don't give the Oireachtas committees real power, which we haven't seen. There's been no presentation of real political reform in this government. And I think the problem is that the characters at the very core of it believe power politics is the way to go. I'm not sure it is.
To have balance here. I mean, there's people that have been decrying Enda at various times for weak leadership. The moment he makes a stance, the same people then go to the other end of the spectrum and say it's the highway or my own way. This is a man who appointed the Seanad, a group of people that had no political allegiance to him, or none that I'm a, diverse voices, many of whom are now being very critical of him. This is a man that put in place the Constitutional Convention, which has led to even more debate in the years to come. And I have to tell you, from dealing with him regularly within the parliamentary party over many, many years, anybody who ever met Enda Kenny personally, as many of us have had, and think we're talking about a my way or the highway man, it's very, very different.
It was that way this week. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
But he was taking a leadership stance in relation to an issue that had to be dealt with, and it was leading his party and his government through it.
OK, we've got to leave. Lisa, you're going to leave us. Do you want to make
one last word? I just think that it'll be interesting to see if the Seanad, when this bill goes into the Seanad next week, I think it'd be very interesting to see if the denizens of that particular, of the upper house, will be quite as acquiescent to the my way or highway approach, considering that he is actually facing the abolition. So you might find a wee revolt there, I think.
And one last point, which I agree with you that the Constitution Convention has worked, and that shows the way we should go. Bring in disparate voices, change the Seanad to allow that sort of space for that to be there permanently. And that's what the Taoiseach could do rather than getting rid of it.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Lise, you're going to leave us, and it's going to take two people to replace you, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. I'm joined in the studio by newly appointed Minister of State Pascal Donoghue. Eamon Ryan, leader of the Green Party and former minister, is with us also. And we've been joined by Tony Foley from DCU and Tim Healy from the Nevin Institute. And that's where we're going. We're going to go to economics now. And inspectors from the IMF, the EU Commission and the ECB are, despite the lovely weather, carrying out their second last review of Ireland's bailout programme as we speak over the weekend. And then next week, Minister Brendan Howland will start talking to ministers from other departments to nail down their budgets ahead of the overall spending decisions. And we'll all find out about those in October. But in the middle of all of this, you've a fairly public desire by the government to ease up on austerity, but it seems that the Troika wants us to plough on. So who is right? Tony. Standard & Poor's say we're doing great work. Well, they upgraded us this week.
Yes.
Everybody was delighted because the sun was shining and the news was good. Isn't it time now for the Irish people to catch a break?
No, I don't think so. We're borrowing money. We're borrowing lots of money. And of course, if people give us money and didn't want to pay it back, I'd say, fine, borrow more of it and so on. But we're still borrowing money. And what we often forget, because we've been through such a miserable several years of austerity, that our borrowing level is still high by European standards. So this year it'll be about 7%. All going well, it'll be a bit below 5% next year. That's high. That's worrying the Dutch and worrying the French and so on. So I don't think we're in a position to basically say, given the uncertainty facing the economy in the future, that we can start relaxing now, as it were. We have to live within our means. Now, that doesn't mean that there's any particular logic for having a balanced government budget. In normal economic circumstances, you'd never have a balanced budget.
But that's what we're striving for.
Yeah, that's true. In good times, you'd have a surplus. In bad times, you'd have a deficit. But we've got ourselves into this mess, aided by the banks and so on. So we're not in normal circumstances in terms of saying, let's relax and see how things go.
Okay.
So I'd broadly go along with the SRI basic argument. They make the comment that the first priority for public policy remains the need to restore order to the public finances. And I think that remains the case, because what we really want to get away from, ideally, is in a sense discussing the public finances, spending lots of months before the budget discussing what will happen. And we need to start talking about how we actually grow the economy, how we develop firms, how we improve efficiency, how we deliver public services. But for the next several months, we'll be focused on what should the deficit be? Should it be up? Should it be down? Should it be use the promissory notes for one thing versus the other? And really, there are very other significant things that we need to be thinking about.
So, Tom, it's just too soon to catch a break. That's what we're hearing.
Well, it's ironic that people are talking about a full fiscal shock therapy of $3 billion this autumn because of growth stalling in the economy. The SRI have argued for not easing back because growth is lower than expected, or could be lower than expected here on. But in fact, growth is stalling partly because of fiscal austerity, severe fiscal austerity.
Which is impacting consumer spending.
Exactly. So I think there's a balance to be struck here. There's a risk, obviously, with any particular course of action. But I think there's a good reason to reduce the adjustment from, say, 3 billion, 3.1 billion to 2 billion in this autumn's budget. That gives just a little bit more slack in terms of consumer expenditure.
But Tony says it's just too soon to be thinking about that.
Well, the difficulty is that the more we front load this austerity, there's a real risk, I think, that particularly the domestic economy will be tipped further into recession. We've seen three successive quarters of stagnation, even some gathering pace in the decline in the early part of this year. Now, I think government needs to be very careful about not adding to that.
And you're meeting the Troika on
Monday,
is it?
Yes, that's correct.
And you'll be making this argument?
Indeed, yes. I think that the argument there is for a reduction in the size of the consolidation from 3 to 2 billion this year in the budget 2014.
And what would you do with the 1 billion then?
Well, it's not as if that we have an extra billion so much to spend. It's that we have scope not to cut back by the extent to which government has previously indicated. Separate to that, there is scope arising from government announcement of the National Pension Reserve Fund to devote over 6 billion to investment over the coming years. I think that should be brought forward, coupled with a tax-based adjustment in the budget mainly, and that we could actually make the 3% target in 2015. I say could because no one can be certain about the outcomes here. I think the balance of risk is pointing towards a smaller fiscal consolidation.
But the big concern the Troika seems to have is about the international economy, upon which we are so reliant. So if we do what you're saying, we could be hit twice, if you like, if that dip continues elsewhere.
There are two pressures. Obviously, they're correct that the international pressure is enormous, and ultimately there are a whole number of possible scenarios here, which, for example, the ESRI have outlined. But I think the domestic policy response needs to be very careful. It needs to be measured, and it needs to avoid doing further harm, so that whatever particular international scenario we're looking at, we can actually maximise the possibility of growth and jobs, which is, after all, the best way to put order in the public finances.
Absolutely. And Tony, when you think about consumer spending, I mean, next year we're going to have the full year of the local property tax and the impending water charges and so on. So if we thought this year was bad,
We could have said that last year, the year before that, exactly the same circumstances arose. Can I
and
just
the economy
clarify,
hasn't been growing, though.
That, yes, but Tom is in favour of austerity. His still has a target of 3% deficit in 2015 and a reduced deficit next year. But the way he's going to get the deficit is he's going to use the promissory note and he's going to have higher taxes than would otherwise be the case. And the purpose of that is to leave public expenditure alone, to basically make a minor adjustment of 350 million in public expenditure instead of the much larger government intention. So the basic thrust of, as I would see, the Neary strategy is a set of circumstances which facilitates us largely leaving public expenditure alone. I don't think the economy should do that. I think, in a sense, we have to adjust public expenditure also. But he's going for the 3% as well. It's just he's using the promissory note and an additional 600 or 700 billion
doing
in taxes to get
way.
There.
OK, Eamon, are you a spender or a saver when it comes to this?
I think we need to do both. I think, where's the growth going to come from? US President said yesterday that a low carbon, clean energy economy can be an engine of growth for decades to come. And I want America to build that engine. Now, that's where every country, advanced economy, is looking for growth. And I think Ireland could actually lead in that. But I think, unfortunately, the government is asleep at the wheel. I'll give you three examples. One of the places we could get growth and spending is instead of taking 400 million out of the ESB, which the government is doing, which they don't have to do under the Troika arrangement. It wasn't specific that they had to take money from such a company. That money could be invested here in a whole range of different projects that would actually develop that clean economy. And it would be a lot of building workers, and it has a return. It has a really good return. Secondly, under this government, the amount of money that's been spent on retrofitting buildings, upgrading them, has halved compared to 3 years ago. So they've actually They've just looked at cutting. They haven't actually managed where the growth can actually come. And I would agree, we should be using some of the pension reserve fund to particularly go into every public building next year, every hospital, every school, every prison, every Garda station, and cut back our fuel bill by spending on making the buildings better. And that has a guaranteed return as well, so it's a good investment. Lastly, the whole generation side in electricity is falling dramatically. We had a real boom a few years ago. We were building a lot of new generation facilities. That stopped. Again, because we're just not getting the policy choices right. So I think we do have to make, I broadly agree with what the ESR is saying, the four-year plan that was set out 3 years ago, I think may work. I mean, we're still in a very risky environment. What's happening in Southern Europe could still pull us down. Anything could happen. But of all the countries, we are actually best placed. And I would commend the government. I think the broad approach they take in implementing that plan is working. So we should keep it going. But it's not enough. And what's missing is the sense of the future. What comes next, where the growth is. Stimulus. And the stimulus should be green. That's what every other modern economy is doing.
There's no reason why that can't happen given the resources that we have.
No, it's not. But the government doesn't get it. They don't see the opportunity. They're not, as I said, if you look at what's actually happened, retrofit spending halved. 400 million taken out of the ESB when they should be getting spending it into our country, and generation expenditure falling as well. Mm. If the market out there thought this government was serious about this green economy, you would see a huge rush of money into this country and you would see that helping us lift.
Okay. Pascal, where do you stand on this? Because there does seem to be, it's a rather subtle message coming from government that they would prefer to maybe ease off austerity in some manner or means coming up to the October budget.
My view is very, very clear on this, which is that what we need to get ourselves to a point is that the taxes that we have coming in here in Ireland will pay for the hospitals, schools and public services that people want in Ireland. And if there's a gap, that somebody will lend it to us. Under our current commitments of the 32 billion euro that needed to be found, around 28 of that 32 billion euro has now been achieved through the huge sacrifices of your listeners. And we now have a final portion of that we have to put in place. And the figures that Tony was referring to earlier on, I mean, the 5% and the 7% there, just to kind of look at those figures, what we're looking at there is that of everything we make and sell in our country, what percentage of that are we borrowing at the moment? And we have a target to get that figure to 3%. And the reason for that is if we get that figure to 3%, the judgment is people will lend to us, number one, but more importantly, people will lend to us at a rate we can afford to borrow at. And that's where we're looking to get to. Now, in terms of this specific target here, and the reason why it's so important is if we achieve that, it means we'll have the taxes that we raise in the future, we'll be able to spend on the things that people want, as opposed to servicing a debt, which we won't want. And hopefully it will create the environment within which other people will want to spend money.
So what should happen in October?
In terms of this particular budget, I believe we have to hit the deficit figure number one. The commitment that we have next year must be achieved. I think it's very, very early in the day to talk about the cash figure that must be achieved to do that, for the simple reason that unlike previous years, this budget will be in October as opposed to December. So at the moment, we're around halfway through the tax year. So we have to look where the revenue is going to come in across that period before we identify the figure. But I believe we have to hit the deficit figure for the main reason why that we have to get out of this terrible bailout programme. And if we can achieve that figure, I think it gives us the best prospects of getting out of this bailout programme.
So no tax cuts?
Well, Richard Bruton, I think, has talked about very, very well about the fact that in many cases, the marginal rates of tax, in other words, the amount of tax that people pay as they earn a bit more, are really high by international standards. So within what we're going to do here at the moment, I do think it's important that we look at how we allocate the tax burden here in Ireland to ensure that it really does reward work. Okay. And I believe we do have to do that.
Tom, you wanted to come back in.
Yes, I'm glad the Minister has made that point about marginal tax rates, because very often people are confusing marginal tax rates with average tax rates. In fact, our average tax rates are quite low. I'm talking here about income tax, USC and PRSI all put together. And that's why I think there is scope to increase the average tax rate for those in the highest income brackets. I'm talking there about households over 110,000 a year, because that's actually where the top 10% are. So I think there are very difficult choices for government, even with an investment stimulus. Even with a smaller fiscal consolidation, as I'm suggesting, government is still faced with very difficult choices this autumn. And the choice will actually come down to, will we cut further into education, health and social protection, or will we address the tax burden, particularly for the top 10%? And that becomes a political choice within the confines even of the 3% deficit.
Tony.
Just pick up something Pascal said there. He mentioned the deficit target. We will, unless something unexpected happens, we will achieve the planned deficit target even if we spent the billion promissory notes, as Tom was suggesting. So the question is whether we go for the original deficit target or we use that extra billion, as it were. In other words, we don't use it and we effectively end up with a lower deficit target than we planned. I would be arguing we should go for the lower deficit, but if Pascal is arguing we should go for the original, say, roughly 5%, well, then that billion is still there.
Is it not a very fluid situation, though, because we saw when we had Standard & Poor's saying we were great and well done and you stuck to the programme, that our borrowing costs reduced. So the numbers change or they're fluid.
Yeah, it is extremely fluid, and in many ways it's quite early in the, you know, quite early in the year to be having this discussion. Now, that's driven by the reason that, as I said, the budget is earlier than normal.
Well, Brendan Howland is meeting people next week to talk about what's, because we
do have to get it all rolling. But where the tax revenue comes in across the summer and up to October will be hugely important. I would make the point, though, that even within the context of all this, I mean, the huge priority, as Tony has said, is doing all we can to get people back to work. And within that, for example, the Jobs Plus scheme was announced this week that will directly pay employers an amount of money up to €10,000 if they take somebody on off the live register.
Okay.
And within that, there's still much we will do.
All right, we're going to leave it there. I've got another story to get to about the Murphy report. And I know you're probably all saying, well, that was published way back in 2009. There was one chapter held back and it was published late yesterday evening. And we're going to talk to Patsy McGarry from the Irish Times about what exactly it said in just a moment. This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. The Murphy report into the handling of clerical child sex abuse in the Dublin Archdiocese was published, as I was saying before the break, in 2009. But one chapter wasn't published until yesterday evening to allow for the trial of Father Patrick McCabe to conclude. Now, he was sentenced to 18 months in March, but the sentence was backdated, so essentially he walked free. The report sharply criticises the Gardaí and three successive archbishops for their handling of the McCabe case. Well, Patsy McGarry from the Irish Times has analysed this newly released information today and is on the line. Patsy, as I was saying there, McCabe's trial concluded in March and the High Court allowed for the publication of the material only just yesterday. Will you remind us about Patrick McCabe and his crimes?
Claire, actually there were two chapters withheld in 2009. One was chapter 19, which dealt with Tony Walsh, and then there was chapter 20, which dealt with Patrick McCabe. Tony Walsh was jailed in December 2011 for 16 years, and these were withheld in order not to prejudice their trials. Patrick Walsh was a serial abuser, as Archbishop Joe Martin described.
Patrick McCabe,
in a statement last night. He was a man that the Archdiocese is aware has abused over 30 children. At the time, the Murphy Commission was aware of 21 complainants, as they put it. He had been in the Pro Cathedral, first of all, that's where the abuse began in the early 1970s. He was in Artane in Clotter Road in Crumlin. And the diocese was aware of his abuse from the early 1970s. The then Archbishop was Dermot Ryan, who, as the Murphy report points out, was a personal friend of his brother, Phelim, another priest who was a classmate of Dermot Ryan's. And Dermot Ryan went to extraordinary lengths, as the Murphy report points out in chapter 20, to protect this man, to protect his reputation, even though he was aware, as the report points out explicitly, of the what he was doing and of the effects of what he was doing on children.
Because that was an argument made, wasn't it, Patsy, over the course of all of this, that these people weren't aware of the impact of abuse on a child.
That they were on a learning curve, which actually Murphy, in her introduction to the report in general, absolutely demolishes as a theory. Doesn't accept that at all. And this proves the fact, particularly where Dermot Ryan was concerned, because he had psychiatric reports from Stroud, which was a centre for the treatment of these men in England, where he was sent in 1981 on the information established by the then Auxiliary Bishop of Dublin, Brendan Comiskey, who, as it points out, had been head of the CORIS, as now known, then known as the Conference of Major Religious Superiors, and was aware of such centres for that reason. He was sent to Stroud in 1981. He was sent then to a similar centre run by the same congregation in New Mexico in 1982, and they had very explicit reports from those centres establishing this man was a paedophile with very strong recidivist tendencies. In fact, he was put in a very strong drug in the United States, in New Mexico, to try to control his libido. There was an ethical debate about whether or not that was correct, and indeed whether the drug would be available in Ireland. But he was sent back here, and he continued to abuse kids.
So when did he come back then to Ireland? He was sent away under Archbishop Ryan, and then he came back.
He came back. He was sent, first of all, back to Ireland in 1983. Then he was sent to Santa Rosa Diocese in California in 1983, and he was there for 3 years, and rumours began to percolate there about him and his activities. He came back to Ireland in 1986 when Kevin McNamara was Archbishop of Dublin. They knew, again, as I said, his history. He was allowed complete free rein in Dublin, unhindered. He had a car, and he abused a nine-year-old boy.
Was he working in a specific parish at that time?
No, he actually was filling in for friends of his, classmates of his, unofficially, and it was in that context he abused this boy. By an extraordinary coincidence, he was staying in a house which was owned then by the chief superintendent of the Gardaí, Joe McGovern, who testified to the Murphy Commission. And the boy's parents went to the Gardaí. The Gardaí brought him in. First of all, it took a statement from the boy and his parents. They brought in McCabe, who was accompanied to the station by a retired Garda sergeant from the district who was a friend of his. And there was no records kept of his statement then. The two guards were interviewed by the Murphy Commission itself, but the file had gone missing.
So he had friends in high places.
He had, and indeed that evening he went to see Chief Superintendent McGovern, who he admitted, as the phrase is put in Chapter 20, he made certain admissions to him. And McGovern, instead of going to the Gardaí with this, went to the parish priest, who went to the archdiocese, of course, and as Murphy puts it, the Gardaí facilitated the archdiocese in the investigation.
So this is the chief superintendent,
yes,
at the time, knew that this man, who had made, as you say, certain admissions about abusing children directly to him, he went to the church with this rather than taking it through the correct Garda channels.
Rather than his own colleagues in the Gardaí.
So let's move then to Archbishop Desmond Connell is also mentioned here. He, did he not, sent McCabe to California again?
Yeah, McCabe then was over and back to the States unofficially most of the time. And in 1987, he was back in Ireland again, and he abused a 14-year-old boy. This came to the attention of the bishops, the auxiliary bishops, who, as Murphy points out, he was on the agenda of all their meetings in 1988. Desmond Connell was then an archbishop-elect. He was made archbishop or consecrated archbishop in March of 1988. And at a meeting in February of 1988, they had decided to send him to a place called Stockton Diocese in California, where he was to work with adult homeless people. They didn't inform Stockton Diocese of his track record. As Murphy puts it very graphically, they let him loose on the Diocese of Stockton without informing the bishop there of his history. And when he was there, Sacramento Diocese in California became aware of his presence. They knew of his history. They assumed that Dublin didn't know he was in Stockton. So they contacted both Dublin and Stockton to inform them of his history. And suddenly he was out of Stockton as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Desmond Connell told by Rome, or senior people in Ireland told by Rome, to laicize him?
In fact, what the auxiliary bishops did, even before they sent him to Stockton, was to contact Rome to have him laicized, pointing out that he could be a source of immense scandal to the church and to the priesthood.
And yet the decision was taken to send him off to Stockton without telling anybody what he was capable of.
That is true, and he was laicized later in that year of 1988.
So what does the report then say specifically about the Garda involvement in the case, Patsy?
Well, what the report says in summary, Claire, at the very end, is that it basically this case summarised or encapsulates, is the word it's used, everything that was wrong with the handling of clerical child sex abuse allegations in the Dublin Archdiocese. And it's the worst case scenario where the guards are concerned also. It's the longest chapter in the Murphy report, 62 pages in length. If people want to read it, it's on justice.ie. It's worth reading. Some of it is pretty painful and very upsetting, not least where some of the victims were concerned. One young fellow who reported the case consistently was threatened with being sued for blackmail by a church institution.
And then there has been a response from Archbishop Dermot Martin to the report.
Yes, and very strongly and very powerfully he points out that this, and again, I mean, he has to be commended on this because he's exceptional in his stance where this issue is concerned. He says that those who decry the Murphy report are wrong, that this is a milestone in the church. church history. It must be accepted. It is what happened. That thanks to this, to it, and to other victims, the victims who have come forward in other cases, the church has now in place very strong child protection structures. I mean, there are over 3,000 approximately people involved in child protection in various Catholic dioceses on the island of Ireland, a small army of people, mostly women, it has to be said, and they are very effective in trying to protect children. But that's been brought about mainly thanks to victims and to reports like the Murphy report.
And what of Patrick McCabe now? I mean, where is he?
Patrick McCabe, I mean, Murphy in the report wasn't hopeful or optimistic that he would be brought back or extradited to Ireland. She does point out that the guards made absolutely no effort to get him back to the country, that they, in 2003, they made cursory inquiries mainly to protect themselves in case of investigation by media. He was brought back in 2010 to Ireland. He was arrested in the States in 2010. He was brought back to Ireland in 2011. He was held in custody for quite a considerable period. He went to jail last October, involving five young men he'd abused. He was brought to court again in March of last year, concerning two more young men he'd abused. And the judge decided, she gave him an 18-month sentence, but because he'd been in custody so long, she backdated the sentence because of his age, etc., and he walked free.
He's 77 now. You've written an analysis piece in the paper today in the Irish Times, and you talk about this happening so recently as being one of the reasons why it's particularly shocking, I suppose.
Well, Claire, we heard from other chapters in the report that back in the early 1960s, then Garda Commissioner Costigan, when it was brought to his attention, photographs that had been taken of children by abuser Father Paul McGuinness under Archbishop John Charles McQuaid. These photographs were sent to the UK for processing. People over there contacted the police there, contacted the guards here. He brought them to Archbishop McQuaid and did nothing further. We thought that was just a characteristic, really, of the period of the 1960s. This is the 1980s, when the guard effectively colluded with the church to protect an abuser and abandoned the responsibility to parents and to children, particularly who've been abused. Mm-hmm. That's not too long ago. I mean, 1988, when
certainly
that,
is not. It's
that
not too long
was made by the bishops of Dublin was 25 years ago.
Patsy, thank you very much for bringing us the detail in chapter 20 of the Murphy. It's difficult to know how to respond. Pascal Donoghue, you stayed with us in studio. It's difficult to know how to respond to that narrative. Have you anything to say?
It's so shocking and upsetting to hear us. I mean, across that period, there was ambiguity about evil. That ambiguity is now gone. I think we have to commend the skies, Archbishop Dermot Martin, and what he has done. The particular line that he used last night is to simply say this is something that must never be forgotten. And that clarity, while it will bring no solace to the victims, is a reminder to us of what we need to do now. And that has to be said. The children's rights referendum has taken place. Statutory guidelines to make it a legal requirement for people to report abuse, in other words, the children's first guidelines, will be coming to the Cabinet before the summer. An agency, the Children and Family Agency, with 4,000 workers in it, will be up and running. The legislation for that's in the door next week.
Okay.
And I have to say, the Gardaí, led by Commissioner Martin Callanan, you know, the ambiguity that may have existed then is gone now.
So recently as the 80s, as Patsy said. Pascal, thank you very much. We wish you well in your new portfolio. Eamon Ryan, who's still with us, thank you for joining us also. And to all of my guests, I'd like to thank them all for being with us. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the sunshine this Saturday afternoon. We're back with you next week.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Research by Leslie Anderson, and audio supervision this week was by Ruth Kennington.